Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interests in mind. Use Rocket Mortgage for a transparent, trustworthy home loan process that's completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. American political polarization already had the country on boil for a while. Donald Trump's campaign populism kicked it up yet another notch. Many wonder what on earth comes next. My guest today says it may be time for a little moderation to steady the boat, hold this whole thing together. This hour on Point, moderation as America's fighting faith. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Does moderation sound wimpy to you right now, or like something we may need to get through? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Special welcome today to our newest listeners across the country, from Georgia and the Carolinas to the Dakotas, Nevada, Alaska. We look forward to hearing from you. We'll hear in a few minutes from a couple of thinkers who aren't so sure moderation is the way to go right now. But first, a deep student of moderation who says we need it. Joining me now from Bloomington, Indiana, via Skype, is Aurelien Kreyutsu, professor of political science at Indiana University in Bloomington there, author of the new book Faces of Moderation, The Art of Balance in an Age of Extremes. You can link to an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Aurelien Kreyutsu, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
You know, a lot of people right now might listen to hear the word moderation and say, what are you talking about? The Trump people have come to town and they've got a lot of big things they want to do. Some of them sound immoderate. Opposition to Donald Trump is digging in and may say, well, the Republicans didn't want to work with Barack Obama. Why should we be moderate with Donald Trump? Why moderation now? Why moderation in a time of extremes, if you will?
Well, it's a good question, and that's why I think writing about moderation in this time is a great idea. It's also an old idea. I put myself in a long and outstanding tradition that goes back to Aristotle and goes through the works of Montesquieu and Tocqueville. But I'm not the only one to have made this point. As the listeners may know, David Brooks in the New York Times and Peter Wiener also in the New York Times have pointed the importance of moderation as a very complex virtue that is precisely needed in a time of ideological polarization like ours today. There are many benefits of moderation, and we can talk more about this during the broadcast.
Yep.
But I would say that the most important one is that moderates actually are not wimpy people. There is a courage behind moderation. They are able to think politically rather than ideologically, and that's a great advantage. And first and foremost, I would say, moderates work with a worldview that is not binary, it's not bipolar, it's not Manichaean, black and white.
Mm-hmm.
And they can actually engineer compromises. And those are the stuff that our politics are made of today. And without compromises, our representative government and our institutions cannot simply work.
But did these thinkers who championed moderation, did they do it in a time of relative harmony, when it was easy to see moderation at work? When there are more extreme threats, does moderation really have enough horsepower to make a difference?
This is a great question, Tom. Actually, three of the authors that are discussed in my book, Raymond Aron in France, Norberto Bobbio in Italy, and Ada Michnik in Poland, worked their way in a time of crisis. Aron wrote about political moderation at a point in time when the institutions of the Fourth Republic in France were under assault, when he was distrusted by people on the left. Students in Paris used to say, and this is a famous saying, better to be wrong with Sartre than to be right with Aron, and they were wrong on that. And then he was able to put forward an agenda for moderation, for reforming the French universities at a point in time when there was a great crisis in the May-June days of 1968. In Poland, for example, Ada Michnik put forward an agenda for moderation. He defended the so-called self-limiting revolution that actually sparked the Committee on the Defense of Workers, that led to the famous Solidarity movement that ended up dismantling communism in Poland in 1989. It took 13 years to do so, but that agenda for moderation that was pushed by thinkers like Michnik and others was actually quite effective in a time of crisis. In Italy, Norberto Bobbio had been engaged in a dialogue with the Italian communists for over 40 years, trying to convince them that they need to support the principles of constitutionalism at a time when Italy went through, I think, over 40 governments. There were constitutional crises over and over again. So those are trying times for moderates, and they were able to put forward agendas that were effective.
Speak to Trump listeners right now who may be thinking, look, we won the presidential election. Republicans have both houses of the U.S. Congress now. This is no time for moderation. We have the steering wheel. We have the, you know, the power, and we want to use it.
That may be the case, and I would say I would try to speak, and the book actually tries to speak to people who are committed on both sides. And I would want to say that it's quite important to reach out to people on the other side of the aisle. The political system is never black and white. There is no division between bad and evil on one side and good and light on the other. The essential functioning of our representative government depends on the ability of reaching out to people who disagree with you, who are your, let's say, opponents without being your enemies. Our government and our institutions depend on the ability to sit together and talk to each other despite of our differences and beyond our differences. And I think that that's very important for everyone to know, that there's not such a division between light and darkness, between good and evil. And I think that we live in a world that has many nuances of gray, and gray too can be beautiful. That's what I would want to tell everyone.
That's easy for you to say, but let's say you're an environmentalist and you feel that there's an urgent crisis around CO2 on the planet, and you think even the steps we've taken so far have not been enough. And here comes Donald Trump, and he says, well, let's fire up the coal plants again. That doesn't sound like a conversation where there's no black and white. It sounds like a lot of black and white.
Absolutely. There are some issues on which the situation is like the one that you described. And that's why moderation is a difficult virtue, because it's not a virtue for all season and for all people. There are certain issues on which the, let's say, the decision that should be made is more or less clear. The environmental issue is, in my view, not one of those issues. There are other issues like fighting totalitarianism, probably fighting Nazism or communism in the Soviet Union. Those are the issues that I would say moderation is not the time to espouse. But on environmentalism, I think that the recourse should be, for example, to common sense. And I think that it might make sense to take precautionary measures now in order to avoid a catastrophe later. So I think that's what I would, the moderate, say. It might not be satisfactory to all sides of the on this agenda.
We've got callers for you on the issue of moderation, and keep bringing those great thinkers in here, Oakeshott and Aron and more. But we've got a very current circumstance, very current situation with a new president coming in and some pretty fiery ideas out there. Jay in Tampa, Florida. Jay, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hello. Frankly, I don't think there's any room to moderate on a white supremacist agenda. And while there are other things that Trump has talked about, that is a core element, a nationalist identity that is centered around whiteness. And as an African-American, that's concerning. But for anybody who doesn't agree, but for anybody who believes in equality and the Constitution, as we understand it, where there is equal protection under the law, there's no room to moderate on a religious registry targeting Muslims. There's no room to moderate on things that are just patently unconstitutional. And I don't think we should wait and see how things unfold, because we know, and we look at history and see that it's not going to go well. So we should be resisting and encouraging everybody to be organized, not patiently waiting to see if it's as bad as people say it will be.
Jay, I appreciate your call from Tampa. Aurelien Kryutsu there in Indiana. How about it? You hear Jay's concern. This is not the time for moderation. This is a time to resist. Put your thinkers to work on his perspective right now on the incoming Trump administration.
I sympathize with Jay's point, and I think I endorse it 100%. And I said before, the difficulty with moderation lies in the fact that there are it is based on judgment. It's based on prudence. There are certain things that it would be prudent to try to carve out the middle ground, and there are certain things on which it would be imprudent. And on the issues raised by the caller in Tampa, I think we all can agree on that. But it's very important to look at, for example, the division in of our country today. There are 65 million people who voted for Donald Trump, and it would be a mistake to claim, I think, Jay doesn't do that, and yep. neither others, but it would be a mistake to claim that they were a basket of deplorables, that they were moved by all racist or negative feelings. And I think that that's the impulse that the moderate would try to instill in others, that we need to reach out and understand. So with some people, dialogue may not be possible. And no matter what, they will be unwilling to espouse moderate positions. But with others, that dialogue might be possible. But on this issue, I think I agree. There is no time. And I think that there are true and false forms of moderation as well. To be a moderate in the 1956 or 1953 in Alabama or Mississippi, I don't think that would have been such a great idea. And it would, in fact, have blocked necessary democratic reforms. But to be a moderate today is different from being a moderate in 1956.
Hard to figure out exactly how this gets applied. I mean, you talk about moderation, potential, the radicalism of moderation as a fighting virtue, and yet it can sound like all compromise.
Well, it's not always compromise, but fighting virtue recognizes the issues precisely that need to be pushed forward. And I think that that's why, as an academic, I try to look at the concrete things rather than argue in general. For me, for example, there are certain things that the thinkers that I have discussed in the book have made very clear. They were for defending the principles of open society at a point in time when those principles were under assault. And I think that's very important to realize. And they were, for example, against dividing the world in binary camps. And that's actually a fighting virtue. It's not a defensive virtue. And that's something that I want to pass on.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a deep call for moderation in a time of extremes, what it takes to stay centered and the value of that in a time when some days it feels like anything could happen. Aurelien Kreutzou is my guest. He's professor of political science at Indiana University. His new book is Faces of Moderation, The Art of Balance in an Age of Extremes. And he looks at philosophers from all the way back to Aristotle, but much more recent as well, in some very tough times in the 20th century, who said, hang on to moderation or you risk losing all. Of course, there are other ways to lose all. You can join us this hour. Whatever happened to the old American reputation for steady, level-headed, get-it-done ways? Do you long for moderation or are you over it? Does it look to you like it's time to be fierce? And if everybody's fierce, what do we end up with? Aurelien Kreutzou there in Bloomington, Indiana, we have a new president coming in, Donald Trump. At some points in the campaign, you can look back and find headlines saying, well, this is a moderate. This is not a political ideologue. He thinks in his own way. What do you see in the temperament, the political profile of President-elect Trump?
For that, I would need to write a new book, but I'm willing to give it a try right now. I would say that if we look at the rhetoric of the president-elect, certainly that rhetoric full of populist overtones, I think, has been anything but moderate. But also those who have been supporting him have demonized their opponents, have demonized the minorities, expressed some form of intolerance towards criticism. And there was a general uncivil tone of the campaign on both sides, I should say, but certainly more so on the GOP side than the other. And I would say anyone who says that I can alone fix things and brags to be able to drain the swamps, speaking about our political system as a swamp, I think ignores the complexity of the political system, which, after all, the outcome of a long evolution. And I think that that's something that I would try to pass on in response to your first question earlier on to those who are supporters of Donald Trump. Our system is not a system that has been created yesterday. It's a system that has been the outcome of a series of compromises at the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia and after that. And this is a good thing. We should cherish complexity rather than try to get rid of it. Someone who says, I alone can fix things, is poised to misunderstand the complexity of the political system. And I think that that's something that I would certainly want to pass on to those who supported Donald Trump or who support anyone on the left, Bernie Sanders as well. I would say that we need to be more humble towards the complexity of our political system, and that system needs to be cherished rather than drained.
Well, here's the sound of Donald Trump with that, I alone can fix it. This was July, of course, at the Republican convention, Cleveland.
Nobody knows the system better than me. Which is why I alone can fix it.
I alone can fix it. What do your thinkers, out of the long tradition of thinking in moderation, do in the face of a leader who may have that attitude? I alone can do this. That's not exactly an invitation to dialogue, to thinking through with others. So how do moderates approach that kind of leader?
Well, that's exactly what Raymond Aron did in France. He had an interesting relationship with President Charles de Gaulle, with whom he fought on the same side against the Nazis. They were both in England at the time. But when the President de Gaulle became again president after in the Fifth Republic in France, Raymond Aron was quite critical towards some of the initiatives taken by President de Gaulle. And he famously was described by someone as a friend in times of crisis and an opponent in times of peace, because he was unwilling to believe that one man can be the savior of a complex political system like the French one or like our system today. So I think that the example of the relationship between Raymond Aron and President Charles de Gaulle is an interesting example in this regard, because it gives us a sense of how moderates distrust people who can come up with the simple solutions. Having said that, I should add that Aron admired de Gaulle for what he had achieved, but he was willing to criticize de Gaulle when he was displaying some initiatives that Aron thought were unproductive.
But do strongman leaders listen to moderates or just roll over them, brush them aside?
Well, probably they brush them aside most of the time. But in this case, de Gaulle was an interesting example, because he did listen to Aron. Aron wrote editorials for 31 years in influential French newspapers, Le Figaro and then L'Express, and his voice was very well respected. It depends on the national culture, I guess. In France, intellectuals have always had more sway and a stronger public image than in the United States. But I do think that today, the voice of social media, the voice of activists, the voice of academics like myself and others can make a difference. And I think it's the public opinion that is strengthened as a result and may actually have an impact. We shouldn't think in terms of one leaders. We are a big country. It's a federal system. There are many centers of power in the country. And I think that people have a say in influencing those centers of powers.
Of course, nobody has more followers, or few have more followers on Twitter than Donald Trump himself. Jennifer Rubin and Michelle Goldberg join us in just a moment. A few callers here first. Kanan in Augusta, Maine. Kanan, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I am strongly in favor of moderation as a progressive liberal academic. I really believe that a moderate political system and the mechanism of political moderation is the only way to ensure progressive but also stable political progress that keeps precedent in mind and doesn't destroy it. And I think, given if we look back at the changes in American politics of the last 20 or even 30 years,
yeah.
I mean, 30 years ago, we could never imagine that we would have fully sanctioned gay marriage in this country. I mean, that's a real step forward. And it's not just the step forward that was. This wasn't a decision made by activists. This was a path opened by activists that was sanctioned by a massive American center that looks one way and looks the other and makes a lot of the decisions. And when 65 million people in this country vote for someone, no matter who that person is, and I certainly didn't vote for him, but we have to consider why that was. Now, my question, the interviewer yep. mentioned the use of social media, and my perspective has been so far that Facebook, which chooses what I see for me, and has made my feed completely blue and has made others' feeds completely red,
yep.
is actually been a source of fragmentization and has enabled the extremizing, this extremifying trend in American public discourse. And I wanted to know, your opinion on that as a scholar of this sort of thing.
Aurelian, there in Bloomington, thank you very much, Kanan. Yes. What about it? Everybody in their own echo chamber now, does that throw moderation out the window? We don't even have the threads of understanding that meet?
This is a good point about the echo chamber and the social media, but nothing prevents people from, for example, if you are a Democrat, to read the Wall Street Journal, or if you are a Republican, to read the New York Times. And I think that's a safe lesson of hygiene, intellectual hygiene, if you wish. But it's true that people tend to speak to the converted, to those, and seek information from those who think in the same way. But that's exactly why we need moderation, because we need to learn how those who think differently from us see the world, what kind of lenses, what kind of categories they use. And I think that the social media can help us precisely because we can, establish links with the people with whom we disagree.
But overwhelmingly do not, is at least what I observe. Jack in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Jack, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I tend to be a moderate. I'm a Midwestern boy, born and raised in Ohio.
All right.
But I would like your panelists to respond to a basic question. How would you respond to those of us, many millions of Americans, who believe we have an oligarchy in this country and have not had a democracy in the United States for over 30 years? So I'm saying 1-3% of the wealthiest and most influential people of America run the government.
Jack, let me pick it up right there. Aurelian Karyutsu, if you agree, or if others in history have faced a time when they felt their democratic levers were not really potent, that there were powers above that were kind of running the system above their heads, how does moderation come in?
I think a moderate position would accept that we do have a problem with inequality in this country, but a moderate person would also acknowledge that he or she doesn't know what the solutions are before they define the problem. So I don't think there is a book that would tell us how to reduce inequality, and I think that's where the style of the moderate would make a difference. But we do have a problem with the balance in this country, and moderates seek to keep the ship of the state on an even keel. And I think that dealing with the problem of inequality is a priority on the agenda of any moderate.
Aurelian Karyutsu, please stand by there in Indiana. Right now, Michelle Goldberg joins us from New York, columnist for Slate magazine. Michelle, thanks a lot for being with us here.
Hey, thank you for having me.
And from Washington, Jennifer Rubin is here, opinion writer, conservative with The Washington Post. Jennifer, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Jennifer, you're fairly conservative. Here comes Donald Trump. Is this a time for moderation? Is moderation a way just to ask Democrats to put down their guns?
Well, I was a very vocal anti-Donald Trump Republican, and I do agree with your first guest that moderation is, in essence, the American system. We have divided government by party and by branch and by federal level. We have to work with one another, and I think it's essential, as your guest said, for us to sustain certain policies from one election cycle to the next. One of the things that we are seeing right now is how tenuous Barack Obama's agenda is, because much of it was passed without Republican buy-in. So it may be a temporary victory to be immoderate, to go your own way, to say you are the only one who can do something. But our system is such that unless you have legislative, executive buy-in, plus the public on board, those gains are going to be ephemeral. They're going to disappear.
Well, that's fair enough, but you oppose Donald Trump. Now he's coming in. So even for your own, let's say, Republican fellow thinkers, get along, go along way here?
No, I think there's a confusion between moderation and passivity. You can be passionate in your moderation. You can be passionate that the way to go is not to round up 11 million people and deport them. At the same time, you are passionate that we need some level of border security. It is a mistake to equate moderation with simply splitting the baby halfway, and mm-hmm. it's a mistake to assume that moderation is deference or accommodation. Those are very, very different things. And I think there are many instances in which Donald Trump is so extreme that the answer to him is not an extreme on the other end, but is to find common ground which will not only bring the country together, but which will be a sustaining coalition over time. And I think that's true on domestic issues. I think it's true on foreign policy issues. And that's traditionally how we've worked. Although Republicans would disagree, FDR was a moderate. He did not destroy the capitalist system. He saved the capitalist system at a time when voices on the right and the left were screaming for radicalism. But he chose a path that he knew was sustainable over time, that was in accord with the American tradition, both politically as well as economically. And over time, look how much of that agenda has been sustained. The whole idea of a more activist federal government really began with FDR, who was not a radical.
Plenty of Republicans at the time sure saw him that way.
I do, but in retrospect, he really wasn't. We saw what extremist was. We saw communism. We saw fascism in Europe.
Yeah.
And this was a middle way.
Michelle Goldberg, there has been a lot of thinking over the years that kind of moderation, a middle way, is the American way. Now you've got a president who's put some fairly extreme ideas on the table, and everybody's waiting to see what happens. Some are Arilin Kraitsu saying, look, at all times we need a sense of moderation or things just fall apart. You're out there saying, maybe no way. You wrote recently that the CIA concluded that Hillary Clinton had won the election with an assist from a hostile foreign power. Pitchfork-waving Republicans would be demanding that she resign for the good of the nation. Should Democrats be thinking about moderation now or something else, Michelle?
Well, I mean, temperamentally, I'm sympathetic to some of what the previous guests have spoken of. You know, mm-hmm. people say a liberal is somebody who can't take their own side in an argument. And yeah. I am, you know, I do think that kind of ideologically or programmatically, there are a lot of shades of gray of these issues. But politically, Jennifer Rubin said that it blamed Obama's so-called immoderation for the reason that he couldn't get any Republican buy-in to his agenda. And I see it very differently. I mean, I see Obama as a mild, moderate, compromising figure who faced a total wall of opposition from an extremely radical Republican Party that decided to thwart him at every turn. And so I see Obama to some extent as a cautionary tale about the limits of moderation, because none of his outreach, none of his, you know, sort of intellectual generosity, the fact that his health care plan, rather than being the radical overhaul that many liberals and leftists wanted, was, you know, sort of a moderate reworking of a plan put forward by Mitt Romney. And nevertheless, there was no cooperation. There was a total wall of opposition to his attempt to appoint a Supreme Court justice, which was, you know, very much his right and his due. And so, as I see it, for decades now, the Republican Party has been, you know, systematically destroying moderation in this country, systematically destroying the ground on which moderation could become possible, which is a common understanding of reality. We now live in completely non-intersecting realities, so there's very little. I don't see how you kind of come together when you can't even agree about the very, you know, very basic facts about the world in which we live. Now we've gotten to a point where I think because of the trends that the Republican Party has been, pursuing over the last several decades, we're now at a point of existential peril for this country. We have this, this ghastly man who's going to take office. We are on the cusp of autocracy. It is far from clear, I think, that democracy survives. This is not a time for moderation. This is a time for total sustained opposition.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interests in mind. Rocket Mortgage provides a transparent online process that helps you understand all the details of your home loan. You can even adjust the rate and length of your loan in real time to make sure you get the right mortgage solution for you. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a deep call for moderation in a time of extremes. From Aurelien Kreyutsu, his new book is Faces of Moderation, The Art of Balance in an Age of Extremes. He looks back at philosophers of moderation. Well, you can take you all the way back to Aristotle, but right in the 20th century, when we had some pretty big extremes, Nazism and more, socialism, communism, and says moderation is a requirement for civil discourse to hold together and productive solutions to be found. On the other hand, here we are in a time when a lot of people are pretty uneasy, uncertain about what comes next and what the right way of standing or even perhaps confronting might be. Jennifer Rubin joins us from the Washington Post, conservative there. Michelle Goldberg joins us from Slate Magazine on the liberal side there. You may be thinking about this issue as well. If everybody's fierce, what do we end up with? And is our democracy strong enough to weather a kind of unending standoff? Is it brave now to be moderate, or is it a cop-out? Lots of listeners responding online. Aurelien there in Indiana, prima donna, says, I'd be the first to jump on the moderation bandwagon, but now the fascists are in town and we should resist. Well, by that or not, that kind of fear is out there. Cyril says moderate conversation is a necessary antidote for polarized shouting. Nick says throughout American history, moderation has meant coddling white supremacists. I mean, again and again, Professor Kreyutsu, this idea right now that moderation sounds like surrender comes up. Speak to people with that concern.
Well, I wish, first of all, they would buy my book, and I hope they will.
But of course you do.
I would try to remind them, for example, of a beautiful quote from Albert Camus. I know that's not well known, maybe, but Camus said this: "Our world does not need tepid souls; it needs burning hearts, men who know the proper place of moderation." As the two previous speakers have pointed out, there are many confusions about moderation that we need to dispel. And one of the things that I would point out is that moderation is not necessarily to be found in the center, in a lukewarm place. It has an agenda. It's an agenda that has a political vision behind it. As I mentioned it, I tend to think that the most important part of this agenda is political trimming, keeping the balance. The image on the first cover of my book is a man who walks on a thin row, on a thin wire, is a funambulist, someone who is always in great danger of falling. But that person actually needs a lot of science, a lot of courage, a lot of luck, and a lot of art to stay on that thin wire. And I think that's what moderates do. It's a very difficult virtue. It's a virtue not for those who seek a comfortable place. It's a virtue that is in great demand today because so few of us, actually, while speaking about moderation, can practice it. But there is a vision of the public good. In relation to a previous question about inequality, we do need to accept that there are major inequalities in our country today, and we need to tackle those. That's what moderates would be inclined to do. And I think that that's very important for everyone to know, that moderation is an agenda that doesn't seek to protect the status quo. That's something that has come up in the responses from the listeners. It's an agenda that has a certain vision of the public good, and that vision of the public good is something that we need to focus on. And I think that we need to think as citizens, not as partisans. And this is what Michelle Goldberg, I think, was intimating earlier when she was talking. I think moderation and compromise should be seen as a national agendas for the public good.
Citizens, not partisans. Yeah, Michelle?
Oh, that wasn't me, but I would say that, again, as far as I'm, I sort of feel like, you know, Charlie Brown with the football.
With the football,
at this point.
Yeah.
It seems to me that liberals, you know, kind of preach a gospel of moderation against. And I'm going to say an enemy at this point, because I think that for a long time we kind of deluded ourselves that conservatives and Republicans regarded us as the opposition. And one of the things both the election of Donald Trump and Donald Trump himself has made clear is that we really are enemies. I mean, Donald Trump, you know, taunted the majority of Americans who voted against him with his New Year's Day message, you know, talking about how sweet it is to finally, you know, to feel this revenge against his enemies, which is us. And the fact, I wish that there was a common civic ground on which we all kind of could come together and hash out the future of that country. But it seems to me that that ground has been burned and salted. And given the extent of the threat that we're now under, I think that the first has to come kind of basic self-defense and basic trying, you know, as best we can to salvage whatever we might be able to salvage of our civic culture and liberal democracy over the next 4 years. And then might be the time for moderation as we figure out, you know, God willing, we'll have a chance to figure out how to put everything back together again.
Forget moderation. Really, Jennifer, please.
The question is really, do you want to win or do you want to feel good? Let me give a specific example, which I think speaks to what moderates can accomplish and what the purpose of moderation is.
Okay.
Right now, if Democrats say we will oppose him on everything, we will brook no compromise, they will lose on everything. Because right now, to my chagrin as a Republican, frankly, the Republicans have all the chits on their side of the table. Let's take Obamacare. If you believe with all of your heart and soul that either Obamacare or some system of universal health care is important for the country, what do? You find 51 votes between Republicans and Democrats in the United States Senate. You go to people like Susan Collins. You go to people like Jeff Flake. You even go to people like John McCain. And you reach a consensus that, for example, here's a moderate position.
Okay.
We're not going to destroy Obamacare before we have an alternative that is just as good. That is a moderate approach and a moderate outcome, probably the only one that could possibly be successful into opposing a very radical scheme to, in essence, pull out health care for millions and millions of Americans. That's the difference, I think, between moderation and compromise or acquiescence. Moderates aren't acquiescing, aren't accepting a repeal, a loss of health care for millions and millions of Americans. They're thinking strategically. They're thinking within the constitutional system. What can the Senate do? What can the House do? They're looking to build majorities. And that's essentially how you have to fight when you don't have any other cards in your hand.
Michelle, are you willing to go to that spot, Michelle, given the numbers on Capitol Hill?
Well, I mean, I think that it's naive to think that a bill that, say, had 48 Democrats and 3 Republicans could ever get through this Congress or be signed by Donald Trump. I mean, I just don't see the legislative mechanism by which that happens. Republicans dominate both houses. It's going to be a Republican bill that gets through the House and the Senate and that is signed by Donald Trump. And so I don't see where Democrats have any sort of legislative leverage. What they can do, I think, is take a page from Mitch McConnell. And what, you know, Mitch McConnell's strategy was one of total procedural opposition. And you're right, we're going to lose a lot. We're going to lose a lot no matter what. We're going to lose an enormous amount. But you can resist as best you can and hope that, as it did for Republicans, it ultimately pays electoral dividends. Because I think that the message of politics, what Republicans have done to our political system over the last couple of decades, is to show how little there is to be gained by taking this sort of Charlie Brown with the football attempt and kind of assuming conservative good faith and assuming that there really is a bigger goal than pure partisan than pure partisan gain.
But what happens to the country, Michelle, if it's all no for, first from one side for 4 or 8 years, then all no from the other side for 4 or 8 years? What happens to the?
But the thing is, but that's not what's happened, right? I mean, what we have the thing. I think that Democrats, you know, particularly now in their kind of completely weakened state, cannot unilaterally save the country from Republican radicalism. And their attempts to do so, I think, only end up weakening them and putting off the ultimate day of reckoning. When, like I said, I really hope that there comes a time when we can, with good faith, join hands and try to put things back together again. Yep. Mm-hmm. But we're not in a position to do that right now. We're only in a position to try to limit the scope of the wreckage.
Jennifer, do you see Republicans standing up for moderation from within their own ranks if they see what looks like extremism coming down the pike in a Trump administration?
So far, they have been disappointing in that regard. But I would stress with Michelle, we have to stop the emotional and political archaeology. Whatever has gone on has gone on. The question really now is, what do we do to save the Republic? What do we do to save Democratic norms? And the idea is not to pass legislation with three Democrats, as you posit it. It's to prevent bad things, horrendous things from happening. If you have 51 votes that will not repeal Obamacare, 51 votes in opposition with votes from people who have already expressed the view, Lamar Alexander, Jeff Flake, Susan Collins, you've won on that issue. Why would you not pursue that as a common thread? The idea here is to build a coalition, a lasting one, from center-left to center-right that is going to resist these extreme, ridiculous measures that Donald Trump is putting forth.
And okay, so let me just say,
let me finish.
Yeah, okay.
You spoke at length. If you take the position that Democrats on their own are going to have the most virulent, the most extreme, the most isolating opposition to Donald Trump, you will lose on big issues. What I am suggesting is you can actually do what Mitch McConnell did, but in a very different, in a moderate way. You can prevent bad things from happening by pursuing a moderate course.
Is there a new swing power here, Michelle, a new swing power in the Democrats' weakened state, but nevertheless, a new alliance here that sort of breaks the Mitch McConnell's, you know, solid wall of Republicans? Democrats find enough allies, and then they've got, in effect, this centrist.
Well, that's not, I mean, no, because Democrats aren't really in a position to be pushing through legislation.
We're not talking about pushing legislation. We're talking about blocking extremism.
They're not in a position to, well, that's what I think they should be doing, is trying to block extremism. Then, but I don't see that. I don't see any. What you're saying, I think, presumes that there is a large enough block of moderate Republicans who are willing to join with Democrats in the Senate to produce legislation that could that could head off the kind of most egregious plans of the Trumpists. And I don't.
Let me finish.
Do you think that there's
Let's have a dialogue. That's not Mike's speech.
Okay, but what I'm saying is, what is the mechanism?
Three Republicans.
Yeah, okay.
Will not vote for a repeal of Obamacare without an alternative.
Yep.
That's something you can work with. That's not something I'm making up. That's from their public statements and statements they have made to me and others in private. That's something you can work with.
What about that at a practical level, Michelle? Okay.
What I'm saying is, what is the mechanism by which a bill supported by, say, the majority of Democrats in the Senate, with a kind of small number of quote unquote moderate Republicans, what is the mechanism by which that bill gets introduced and pushed through the Congress?
She's talking about blocking a bill. The bill comes up from the Republicans to repeal Obamacare. 48 Democrats say no. Susan Collins says no. Jeff Flake says no. Ben Sasse says no. And two or three others say no. And it does not happen.
I'm all for that. But how is that inconsistent with a policy of opposition?
It's not. It is a position of moderation, of moderate means to achieve moderate aims, meaning we're not going to throw out the system unless we have something just as good.
Do you think, Jennifer, that that would give the Democrats enough leverage then to actually come up with a positive plan along with some moderate Republicans? Or is that's where the mechanism issue comes into question?
This is a great strategy, and I hesitate to say it on the air because Republicans might hear it. Once you prevent them from repealing Obamacare before there's an alternative, you have won. Because truth be told, there's nothing they can pass that would be an alternative to Obamacare. So this is the battle right now, to put together a center-right to center-left coalition that's going to block the, quote, repeal of Obamacare. That is doable with a center-left, center-right coalition, and that's where the game is going to be played.
Michelle, maybe right there is a little chink of light for, I guess, in your view, and maybe Jennifer's as well, toward sustaining something that just doesn't blow up health care for millions of people.
Well, sure. I mean, look, I think I did misunderstand her, because we do agree that I would love to see 48 Democrats join with, a couple of Republicans to block the most destructive parts of the Trump agenda. And I don't see that as being in any way inconsistent with a, you know, kind of ethos of total resistance to Trumpism.
There we found agreement. The professor will be delighted that moderate means presented by moderate people is the answer to extremism. That's Aron. That is what he did with De Gaulle. I think the professor has won the argument.
Are you celebrating there in Indiana?
I'm extremely happy here in Indiana that a reach for compromise has been successful here. But I would want to point out that if 65 million people voted for Trump, we need to realize that if you want to be United States, we need both the Electoral College. Perhaps we can reform the Constitution a little bit, but I doubt it. But we need to understand that 65 million people are not all stupid and they have their own reasons to have voted for someone with whom we may be in disagreement. So the key point for the system is to continue working while we take into account the concerns of these 65 million people.
You know, we start off talking about philosophers and moderation. Before this hour is over, we've heard about the sort of threat to the Republic itself, Aurelian. Do you have that level of concern right now?
I do have that level of concern, but I do not share, for example, Michelle Goldberg's black and white understanding of reality, either or. I do think that there are many good people among the Republicans and many less so good people, and there are many good people among the Democrats and some who are pursuing radical agendas. And I think that we should always keep this in mind.
Let it be noted that for one day early in the year of 2017, the flame of moderation was lit just a little bit right here. We'll see what unfolds during the course of the year and what ends up making sense to all the players. But interesting to try it out. It's become rare. Aurelian Krayutsu's new book is Faces of Moderation. Thank you so much for being with us, Professor.
Thank you for having me, and thanks to University of Pennsylvania Press for publishing it.
Michelle Goldberg at Slate Magazine, come again. Thanks so much for joining us today, Michelle.
Oh, thank you.
And Jennifer Rubin at The Washington Post, same to you. Thanks for being here, Jennifer.
It was a pleasure.
Listeners, thanks for your calls, all the comments online. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.